After urbanities among the Kargish emissaries, Labanin left the audience room. He went to his dressing room, where he could be as alone as a king can be, with his old servant Oak, whom he had known all his life. He slapped the gilded scroll down on a table. "She's in a rat trap," he said. He was shaking. He whipped the dagger he always wore out of its sheath and stabbed it straight down through the High King's message. "A pig in a poke," he said. "A piece of goods. The ring on her arm and the collar around my neck." Oak stared at him in blank dismay. Prince Aaron of Inlad had never lost his temper. When he was a child, he might have wept for a moment, one bitter sob, but that was all. He was too well trained, too well disciplined to give way to anger. And as king, a king who had earned his realm by crossing the land of the dead, he could be stern, but always, Oak thought, too proud, too strong for anger. "They will not use me," Labanin said, stabbing the dagger down again, his face so black and blind with fury that the old man drew back from him in real fear. Labanin saw him. He always saw the people around him. He sheathed his dagger. He said in a steadier voice, "Oak, by my name, I will destroy Thal and his kingdom before I let him use me as a footstool to his throne." And then he drew a long breath and sat down to let Oak lift the heavy gold-weighted state robe from his shoulders. Oak never breathed a word of the scene to anyone. But there was, of course, immediate and continuous speculation about the princess of the Kargs and what the king was going to do about her, or what, in fact, he had already done. He had not said that he accepted the offer of the princess as his bride, for all agreed she had been offered to him as his bride. The language about Ulfaran's ring barely veiled the offer, or the bargain, or the threat. But he had not refused it either. His response, endlessly analyzed, had been to say she was welcome, that all should be as she desired, and that she should live in the river house, the queen's house. Surely that was significant. But, on the other hand, why not in the new palace? Why send her across the city? Ever since Labanin's coronation, ladies of noble houses and princesses of the old royal lineages of Inlad, Ea, and Sheliath had come to visit or to stay at the court. They had all been entertained most royally, and the king had danced at their weddings as one by one they settled for noblemen or wealthy commoners. It was well known that he liked the company of women and their council as well, that he would willingly flirt with a pretty girl and invite an intelligent woman to advise him, tease him, or console him. But no girl or woman had ever come near the rumor of a shadow of a chance of marrying him, and none had ever been lodged in the river house. The king must have a queen, his advisers told him at regular intervals. "You really must marry, Arryn," his mother had told him the last time he saw her alive. "The heir of Morrigh, will he have no heir?" asked the common people. To all of them, he had said in various words and ways, "Give me time. I have the ruins of a kingdom to rebuild. Let me make a house worthy of a queen, a realm my child can rule." And because he was well loved and trusted, and still a young man, and for all his gravity a charming and persuasive one, he had escaped all the hopeful maidens. Until now. What was under the stiff red veils? Who lived inside that unrevealing tent? The ladies assigned to the princess's entourage were besieged by questions. Was she pretty? Ugly? Was it true she was tall and thin? Short and muscular? White as milk? Pockmarked? One-eyed? Yellow-haired? Black-haired? 45 years old? 10 years old? A drooling cretin? A brilliant beauty? Gradually, the rumors began to run one way. She was young, though not a child. Hair neither yellow nor black. Pretty enough, said some of the ladies. Coarse, said others. Spoke not a word of heartache, they all said, and would not learn. Hid among her women, and when forced to leave her room, hid in her red tent veils. The king had paid her a visit of courtesy. She had not bowed to him, or spoken, or made any sign, but stood there, said old Lady Ayessa in exasperation, like a brick chimney. He spoke to her through men who had served as his envoys in the Kargat lands, and through the Karg ambassador, who spoke fairly good Hardik. Laboriously he transmitted his compliments and queries as to her wishes and desires. The translators spoke to her women, whose veils were shorter and somewhat less impenetrable. Her women gathered round the motionless red pillar and mumbled and buzzed and returned to the translators, and the translators informed the king that the princess was content and required nothing. She had been there half a month when Tanar and Tahanu arrived from Gaunt. Labanan had sent a ship and a message begging them to come shortly before the Kargad fleet brought the princess, and for reasons that had nothing to do with her or King Thal. But the first time he was alone with Tanar, he burst out, "What am I going to do with her? What can I do?" "Tell me about it," Tanar said, looking somewhat amazed. Labanan had spent only a brief time with Tanar, though they had written a few letters over the years. He was not yet used to her hair being gray, and she seemed smaller than he remembered her. But with her he felt immediately, as he had 15 years earlier, that he could say anything and she would understand. "For 5 years, I've built up trade and tried to keep on good terms with Thal, because he's a warlord and I don't want my kingdom pinched, as it was in Maharian's reign, between dragons in the west and warlords in the east. And because I rule in the sign of peace. And it went well enough till this. Till he sends this girl out of the blue, saying, 'If you want peace, give her Eltharin's ring. Your ring, Tanar. Yours and Ged's.'" Tanar hesitated a while. "She is his daughter, after all. What's a daughter to a barbarian king? Goods. A bargaining piece to buy advantage with, you know that. You were born there." It was unlike him to speak so, and he heard it himself. He knelt down suddenly, catching her hand and putting it over his eyes in a sign of contrition. "Tanar, I'm sorry. This disturbs me beyond all reason. I can't see what to do." "Well, as long as you do nothing, you have some leeway. Maybe the princess has some opinion of her own. How can she? Hidden in that red sack. She won't talk, she won't look out, she might as well be a tent pole." He tried to laugh. His own uncontrollable resentment alarmed him, and he tried to excuse it. "This came on just as I had troubling news from the west. It was for that that I asked you and Tahanu to come, not to bother you with this foolishness." "It isn't foolishness," Tanar said. But he brushed the topic away, dismissed it, and began to talk about dragons. Since the news from the west had been troubling indeed, he had succeeded in not thinking about the princess at all, most of the time. He was aware that it was not his habit to handle matters of state by ignoring them. Manipulated, one manipulates others. Several days after their conversation, he asked Tanar to visit the princess, to try to get her to talk. After all, he said, they spoke the same language. "Probably," Tanar said. "I never knew anybody from Hur at Hur. On Atuan, we call them barbarians." He was chastised. But, of course, she did what he asked. Presently, she reported that she and the princess spoke the same language, or nearly the same, and that the princess had not known that there were any other languages. She had thought all the people here, the courtiers and ladies, were malicious lunatics, mocking her by chattering and yapping like animals without human speech. As well as Tanar could tell, she had grown up in the desert, in King Thal's original domain on Hur at Hur, and had only been very briefly at the imperial court in Awabath before she was sent on to Havnor. "She's frightened," Tanar said. "So she hides in her tent. What does she think I am? How could she know what you are?" He scowled. "How old is she?" "Young, but a woman." "I can't marry her," he said with sudden resolution. "I'll send her back. A returned bride is a dishonored woman. If you send her back, Thal might kill her to keep the dishonor from his house. He'll certainly consider that you intend to dishonor him." The look of fury came into his face again. Tanar forestalled him. "Barbarian customs," he said stiffly. He strode up and down the room. "Very well. But I will not consider this girl as queen of the kingdom of Morad. Can she be taught to speak Hardic? A few words, at least? Is she unteachable? I'll tell Thal that a Hardic king can't marry a woman who doesn't speak the language of the realm. I don't care if he doesn't like it. He needs the slap. And it buys me time." "And you'll ask her to learn Hardic? How can I ask her anything if she takes it all for gibberish? What possible use is there in my going to her? I thought perhaps you'd speak to her, Tanar. You must see what an imposition this is. Using this girl to make Thal appear my equal. Using the ring you brought us, as a trap. I cannot even seem to condone it. I'm willing to temporize, to delay, in order to keep the peace, nothing more. Even that much deceit is vile. Tell the girl what you think best. I will have nothing to do with her. And he went out in a righteous wrath, which cooled slowly into an uneasy feeling much resembling shame. When the Kargish emissaries announced they would be leaving soon, Labanon prepared a carefully worded message for King Thal. He expressed his appreciation of the honor of the princess's presence in Hafnor, and the pleasure he and his court would have in introducing her to the manners, customs, and language of his kingdom. He said nothing at all about the ring, about marrying her, or about not marrying her. It was in the evening after his conversation with the dream-troubled sorcerer from Taon that he met for the last time with the Kargs and gave them his letter to the High King. He read it aloud first, as the ambassador had read aloud Thal's letter to him. The ambassador listened complacently. "The High King will be pleased," he said. All the time he was talking amenities to the emissaries and displaying the gifts he was sending to Thal, Labanon puzzled over this easy acceptance of his evasiveness. His thoughts all came to one conclusion. He knows I'm stuck with her. To which his mind made a passionate, silent answer. Never. He inquired whether the ambassador would be going by the river house to bid his princess farewell. The ambassador looked at him blankly as if he had been asked if he was going to say goodbye to a package he had delivered. Labanon felt the anger rising in his heart again. He saw the ambassador's face change a little, taking on a wary, placating look. He smiled and wished the emissaries a fair wind to the Kargad lands. He went out of the audience chamber into his own room. Rites and ceremony hedged most of his acts. And as king, he must be in public most of his life. But because he had come to a throne empty for centuries, a palace where there were no protocols, he had been able to have some things as he liked them. He had kept ceremony out of his bedroom. His nights were his own. He said goodnight to Oak, who would sleep in the anteroom, and shut the door. He sat down on his bed. He felt tired and angry and strangely desolate. Around his neck he always wore a slight gold chain with a little pouch of cloth of gold on it. In the pouch was a pebble, a dull black bit of rock, rough-edged. He took it out and held it in his hand as he sat and thought. He tried to turn his mind away from all this stupidity about the Kargish girl by thinking about the sorcerer Alder and his dreams. But all that came into his mind was a painful envy of Alder for having gone ashore on Gaunt, having talked with Ged, having stayed with him. That was why he felt desolate. The man he called his lord, the man he had loved above all others, wouldn't let him come near, wouldn't come to him. Did Ged believe that because he had lost his wizardly power, Labanon must think less of him, must despise him? Given the power that power had over the minds and hearts of men, it was not an implausible thought. But surely Ged knew him better, or at least thought better of him. Was it that, having been truly Labanon's lord and guide, Ged could not bear to be his subject? That might indeed be hard for the old man to bear, the blunt, irrevocable reversal of their status. But Labanon remembered very clearly how Ged had knelt to him, down on both knees, on Roch Nol, in the shadow of the dragon, and in the sight of the masters whose master Ged had been. He had stood up and kissed Labanon, telling him to rule well, calling him my lord and dear companion. He gave me my kingdom, Labanon had said to Alder. That had been the moment he gave it, wholly, freely. And that was why Ged wouldn't come to Hafnor, wouldn't let Labanon come to take counsel with him. He had handed over the power, wholly, freely. He would not even seem to meddle, to cast his shadow across Labanon's light. He has done with doing, the doorkeeper had said. But Alder's story had moved Ged to send the man here, to Labanon, asking him to act as need required. It was indeed strange, Alder's story, and Ged saying that maybe the wall itself was going to fall was stranger yet. What could it mean? And why should one man's dreams bear so much weight? He himself had dreamed of the outskirts of the dry land long ago, when he and Ged the Archmage were traveling together, before they ever came to Salador. And on that westernmost of all the islands, he had followed Ged into the dry land, across the wall of stones, down to dim cities where the shadows of the dead stood in doorways, or walked without aim or purpose in streets lit only by the moveless stars. With Ged he had walked across all that country, a weary way to a dark valley of dust and stones at the foot of the mountains whose only name was Pain. He opened his palm, looked down at the little black stone he held, closed his hand on it again. From the valley of the dry river, having done what they came to do, they had climbed up into the mountains because there was no turning back. They had gone up the road forbidden to the dead, climbing, clamoring over rocks that scored and burned their hands, till Ged could go no farther. Labanan had carried him as far as he could, then crawled on with him to the end of darkness, the hopeless cliff of night. And so had come back with him into the sunlight and the sound of the sea breaking on the shores of life. It was a long time since he had thought so vividly of that terrible journey. But the bit of black stone from those mountains was always over his heart. And it seemed to him now that the memory of that land, the darkness of it, the dust, was always in his mind, just under the bright, various play and movement of the days, although he always looked away from it. He looked away because he could not bear the knowledge that in the end that was where he would come again, come alone, uncompanioned, and forever. To stand empty-eyed, unspeaking, in the shadows of a shadow city. Never to see sunlight or drink water or touch a living hand. He got up abruptly, shaking off these morbid thoughts. He closed the stone in its pouch, made ready for bed, put out the lamp, and lay down. At once he saw it again, the dim, gray land of dust and rock. It rose up far ahead into black, sharp peaks, but here it sloped away, always downward to the right, into utter darkness. "What lies that way?" he had asked Ged as they walked on and on. His companion had said he did not know, that maybe that way there was no end. Labanan sat up, angered and alarmed by the relentless drift of his thought. His eyes sought the window. It looked north. He liked the view from Havnor across the hills to the tall, gray-headed mountain On. Farther north, unseen, across all the width of the great island and the Sea of Ea, was Inlad, his home. Lying in bed, he could only see the sky a clear summer night, the heart of the swan riding high among the lesser stars. His kingdom. The kingdom of light, of life, where the stars blossomed like white flowers in the east and drooped in their brightness to the west. He would not think of that other realm where the stars stayed still, where there was no power in a man's hand, and no right way to go because no way led anywhere. Lying gazing at the stars, he turned his mind deliberately from those memories and from the thought of Ged. He thought of Tanar, the sound of her voice, the touch of her hand. Courtiers were ceremonious, cautious about how and when they touched the king. She was not. She laid her hand on his, laughing. She was bolder with him than his mother had been. Rose, princess of the House of Enlad, had died of a fever 2 years ago, while he was on shipboard, coming to make a royal visit to Barilla on Inlad and the isles south of it. He had not known of her death till he came home to a city and a house in mourning. His mother was there now in the dark country, the dry country. If he came there and passed her on the street, she would not look at him. She would not speak to him. He clenched his hands. He rearranged the cushions of his bed, trying to make himself easy, trying to set his mind away from there, to think of things that would keep him from going back there, to think of his mother living, her voice, dark eyes under the dark arched brows, and delicate hands. Or to think of Tanar. He knew he had asked Tanar to come to Havnor not only to take counsel from her, but because she was the mother that remained to him. He wanted that love, to give it and be given it. The ruthless love that makes no allowances, no conditions. Tanar's eyes were gray, not dark, but she looked right through him with a piercing tenderness, undeceived by anything he said or did. He knew he did well what he had been called to do. He knew he was good at playing king, but only with his mother and with Tanar had he ever known beyond any self-doubt what it was to be king.
Tanar had known him since he was a very young man, not yet crowned. She had loved him then and ever since, for his sake, for Ged's sake, and for her own. He was to her the son who never breaks your heart. But she thought he might yet manage to, if he kept on being so rageful and dishonest about this poor girl from Hur Atur. She attended the final audience of the emissaries from Awabath. Labanad had asked her to be there, and she was glad to come. Finding Kargs at the court when she came there at the beginning of summer, she had expected them to shun her, or at least to eye her askance. The renegade priestess who, with the thieving hawk mage, had stolen the ring of Aerith Akbi from the treasury of the tombs of Atuan, and traitorously fled with it to Havnor. It was her doing that the archipelago had a king again. The Kargs might well hold it against her. And Thole of Hur Atur had restored the worship of the twin gods and the Nameless Ones, whose greatest temple Tanar had despoiled. Her treason had been not only political, but religious. Yet that was long ago, 40 years and more, almost the stuff of legend, and statesmen remember things selectively. Thole's ambassador had begged the honor of an audience with her and had greeted her with elaborately pious respect, some of which she thought was real. He called her Lady Arha, the Eaten One, the one ever reborn. She had not been called by those names for years, and they sounded very strange to her, but it gave her a keen, rueful pleasure to hear her native tongue and to find she could still speak it. So she came to bid the ambassador and his company goodbye. She asked him to assure the High King of the Kargs that his daughter was well, and she looked admiringly a last time at the tall, raw-boned men with their pale, braided hair, their plumed headdresses, their court armor of silver mesh interwoven with feathers. When she lived in the Kargad land, she had seen few men of her own race. Only women and eunuchs had lived at the place of the tombs. After the ceremony, she escaped into the gardens of the palace. The summer night was warm and restless, flowering shrubs of the gardens stirring in the night wind. The sounds of the city outside the palace walls were like the murmur of a quiet sea. A couple of young courtiers were walking entwined under the arbors. Not to disturb them, Tanar walked among the fountains and the roses at the other end of the garden. Labanan had left the audience scowling again. What was wrong with him? So far as she knew, he had never before rebelled against the obligations of his position. Certainly he knew that a king must marry and has little real choice as to whom he marries. He knew that a king who does not obey his people is a tyrant. He knew his people wanted a queen, wanted heirs to the throne. But he had done nothing about it. Women of the court had been happy to gossip to Tanar about his several mistresses, none of whom had lost anything by being known as the king's lover. He had certainly managed all that quite well, but he couldn't expect to do so forever. Why was he so enraged by King Thole's offering him a perfectly appropriate solution? Imperfectly appropriate, perhaps. The princess was something of a problem. Tanar was going to have to try to teach the girl Hardik, and to find ladies willing to instruct her in the manners of the archipelago and the etiquette of the court, something she certainly wasn't capable of herself. She had more sympathy with the princess's ignorance than with the courtier's sophistication. She resented Labanan's failure or inability to take the girl's point of view. Couldn't he imagine what it was like for her? Brought up in the women's quarters of a warlord's fortress in a remote desert land, where she probably had never seen any man but her father and uncles and some priests, suddenly carried off from that changeless poverty and rigidity of life by strangers, on a long and frightening sea voyage, abandoned among people whom she knew of only as irreligious and bloodthirsty monsters who dwelt on the far edge of the world, not truly human at all, because they were wizards who could turn into animals and birds, and she was to marry one of them. Tanar had been able to leave her own people and come to live among the monsters and wizards of the West because she had been with Ged, whom she loved and trusted. Even so, it had not been easy. Often her courage had failed. For all the welcome the people of Havnor had given her, the crowds and cheering and flowers and praise, the sweet names they called her, the White Lady, the Peacebringer, Tanar of the Ring. For all that, she had cowered in her room in the palace those nights long ago, in misery because she was so lonely, and nobody spoke her language, and she didn't know any of the things they all knew. As soon as the rejoicings were over and the ring was in its place, she had begged Ged to take her away, and he had kept his promise, slipping away with her to Gaunt. There she had lived in the old mage's house as Ogion's ward and pupil, learning how to be an archipelagan, till she saw the way she wanted to follow for herself as a woman grown. She had been younger than this girl when she came to Havnor with the ring, but she had not grown up powerless as the princess had, though her power as the one priestess had been mostly ceremonial, nominal. She had taken real control of her fate when she broke with the grim ways of her upbringing and won freedom for her prisoner and herself. But the daughter of a warlord would have control over only trivial things. When her father made himself king, she would be called princess. She would be given richer clothing, more slaves, more eunuchs, more jewelry, until she herself was given in marriage, but she would have no say in any of it. All she ever saw of the world outside the women's quarters would be through window slits in thick walls, through layers of red veiling. Tanar counted herself lucky not to have been born on so backward and barbaric an island as Hur-Etur, never to have worn the Feag. But she knew what it was to grow up in the grip of an iron tradition. It behooved her to do what she could to help the princess, so long as she was in Havnor, but she didn't intend to stay here long. Strolling in the garden, watching the fountains glimmer in starlight, she thought about how and when she could go home. She did not mind the formalities of court life, or the knowledge that under the civility simmered a stew of ambitions, rivalries, passions, complicities, collusions. She had grown up with rituals and hypocrisy and hidden politics, and none of it frightened or worried her. She was simply homesick. She wanted to be back on Gaunt with Ged in their house. She had come to Havnor because Labanan sent for her and Tahanu, and Ged if he would come. But Ged wouldn't come, and Tahanu wouldn't come without her. That did frighten and worry her. Could her daughter not break free from her? It was Tahanu's counsel Labanan needed, not hers. But her daughter clung to her, as ill at ease, as out of place in the court of Havnor as the girl from Hur-Etur was, and like her, silent, in hiding. So Tanar must play nursemaid, tutor and companion now to both of them, two scared girls who didn't know how to take hold of their power. Well, she wanted no power on earth except the freedom to go home where she belonged and help Ged with the garden. She wished they could grow white roses like these at home. Their scent was so sweet in the night air. But it was too windy on the Overfell, and the sun was too strong in summer, and probably the goats would eat the roses. She went back indoors at last and made her way through the eastern wing to the suite of rooms she shared with Tahanu. Her daughter was asleep, for it was late. A flame, no bigger than a pearl, burned on the wick of a tiny alabaster lamp. The high rooms were soft, shadowy. She blew out the lamp, got into bed, and soon sank toward sleep. She was walking along a narrow, high-vaulted corridor of stone. She carried the alabaster lamp. Its faint oval of light died away into darkness in front of her and behind her. She came to the door of a room that opened off the corridor. Inside the room were people with the wings of birds. Some had the heads of birds, hawks, and vultures. They stood or squatted motionless, not looking at her or at anything, with eyes encircled with white and red. Their wings were like huge black cloaks hanging down behind them. She knew they could not fly. They were so mournful, so hopeless, and the air in the room was so foul that she struggled to turn, to run away, but she could not move. And fighting that paralysis, she woke. There were the warm shadows, the stars in the window, the scent of roses, the soft stir of the city, Tahanu's breathing as she slept. Tanar sat up to shake off the remnants of the dream. It had been of the painted room in the labyrinth of the tombs, where she had first met Ged face to face 40 years ago. In the dream, the paintings on the walls had come to life, only it was not life. It was the endless, timeless unlife of those who died without rebirth, those accursed by the nameless ones, infidels, westerners, sorcerers. After you died, you were reborn. That was the sure knowledge in which she had been brought up. When, as a child, she was taken to the tombs to be Arha, the Eaten One, They told her that she alone of all people had been and would be reborn as herself, life after life. Sometimes she had believed that, but not always, even when she was the priestess of the tombs, and never since. But she knew what all the people of the Kargad lands knew, that when they died, they would return in a new body. The lamp that guttered out, flickering up again that same instant elsewhere, in a woman's womb, or the tiny egg of a minnow, or a wind-borne seed of grass, coming back to be forgetful of the old life, fresh for the new, life after life, eternally. Only those outcast by the earth itself, by the old powers, the dark sorcerers of the Hardic lands, were not reborn. When they died, so said the Kargs, they did not rejoin the living world, but went to a dreary place of half-being where, winged but flightless, neither bird nor human, they must endure without hope. How the priestess Kossel had relished telling her about the terrible fate of those boastful enemies of the god-king, their souls doomed to be cast out of the world of light forever. But the afterlife Ged had told her of, where he said his people went, that changeless land of cold dust and shadow, was that any less dreary, any less terrible? Unanswerable questions clamored in her mind because she was no longer a Karg, because she had betrayed the sacred place. Must she go to that dry land when she died? Must Ged go there? Would they pass each other there uncaring? That was not possible. But what if he must go there, and she be reborn, so that their parting must be eternal? She would not think about all that. It was clear enough why she had dreamed of the painted room, all these years after she had left all that behind her. It had to do with seeing the ambassadors, speaking Kargish again, of course. But still she lay upset, unnerved by the dream. She did not want to go back to the nightmares of her youth. She wanted to be back in the house on the Overfell, lying by Ged, hearing Tehanu's breath while she slept. When he slept, Ged lay still as a stone, but the fire had left some damage in Tehanu's throat, so there was a little harshness always in her breathing, and Tanar had listened to that, listened for it, night after night, year after year. That was life. That was life returning, that dear sound, that slight, harsh breath. Listening to it, she slept again at last. If she dreamed, it was only of gulfs of air and the colors of morning moving in the sky.
Alder woke very early. His little companion had been restless all night, and so had he. He was glad to get up and go to the window and sit sleepily watching a light come into the sky over the harbor. Fishing boats set out, and the sails of ships loom from a low mist in the great bay, and listening to the hum and bustle of the city making ready for the day. About the time he began to wonder if he should venture into the bewilderment of the palace to find what he was supposed to do, there was a knock on his door. A man brought in a tray of fresh fruit and bread, a jug of milk, and a small bowl of meat for the kitten. "I will come to conduct you to the king's presence when the fifth hour is tolled," he informed Alder solemnly, and then, rather less formally, told him how to get down into the palace gardens if he wanted to walk. Alder knew, of course, that there were 6 hours from midnight to noon, and 6 hours from noon to midnight, but he had never heard the hours tolled and wondered what the man meant. He learned presently that here in Havnor, 4 trumpeters went out on the high balcony from which rose the highest tower of the palace, the one that was topped with the slender steel blade of the hero's sword, and at the 4th and 5th hours before noon, and at noon, and at the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd hours after noon, they blew their trumpets, one to the west, one to the north, one to the east, one to the south. So the courtiers of the palace and the merchants and shippers of the city could arrange their doings and meet their appointments at the hour agreed. A boy he met walking in the gardens explained all this, a small, thin boy in a tunic that was too long for him. He explained that the trumpeters knew when to blow their trumpets because there were great sand clocks in the tower, as well as the pendulum of Ath, which hung down from high up in the tower and, if set swinging just at the hour, would cease to swing just as the next hour began. And he told Alder that the tunes the trumpeters played were all parts of the Lament for Aerith Akbi that King Meherian wrote when he came back from Celador. A different one for each hour, but only at noon did they play the whole tune through. And if you wanted to be somewhere at a certain hour, you should keep an eye on the balconies, because the trumpeters always came out a few minutes early. And if the sun was shining, they held up their silver trumpets to flash and shine. The boy was called Rhodey, and he had come with his father, the Lord of Metemma, on Ark, to stay a year in Havnor. And he went to school in the palace, and he was 9, and he missed his mother and his sister. Alder was back in his room in time to meet his guide, less nervous than he might have been. The conversation with the child had reminded him that the sons of lords were children, that lords were men, and that it was not men he need fear. His guide brought him through the palace corridors to a long, light room with windows all along one wall, looking out over Havnor's towers and fantastic bridges that arched over the canals and leapt from roof to roof and balcony to balcony across the streets. He half saw that panorama as he stood near the door, hesitant, not knowing if he should go forward to the group of people at the far end of the room. The king saw him and came to him, greeted him kindly, led him to the others, and introduced them one by one. There was a woman of 50 or so, small and very light-skinned, with graying hair and large gray eyes. "Tanar," the king said, smiling, "Tanar of the Ring." She looked Alder in the eye and greeted him quietly. There was a man of about the king's age, dressed in velvet and airy linens, with jewels on his belt and at his throat, and a great ruby stud in his earlobe. "Shipmaster Tossla," said the king. Tossla's face, dark as old oak wood, was keen and hard. There was a middle-aged man, simply dressed, with a steady look that made Alder feel he could trust him. "Prince Sege of the House of Havnor," said the king. There was a man of 40 or so who carried a wooden staff of his own height, by which Alder knew him as a wizard of the school on Roke. He had a rather worn face, fine hands, an aloof but courteous manner. "Master Onyx," said the king. There was a woman whom Alder took for a servant because she was very plainly dressed and stayed outside the group, turned half away as if looking out the windows. He saw the beautiful fall of her black hair, heavy and glossy as falling water, as Labanon led her forward. "Tehanu of Gaunt," the king said, and his voice rang out like a challenge. The woman looked straight at Alder for a moment. She was young. The left side of her face was smooth copper rose, a dark, bright eye under an arched eyebrow. The right side had been destroyed and was ridged, slabby scar, eyeless. Her right hand was like a raven's curled claw. She put out her hand to Alder in the manner of the people of Ea and the Enlades, as the others had done, but it was her left hand she held out. He touched his hand to hers, palm to palm. Hers was hot, fever hot. She looked at him again, an amazing glance from that one eye, bright, frowning, fierce. Then she looked down again and stood back as if she wished not to be one of them, wished not to be there. "Master Alder bears a message for you from your father, the Hawk of Gaunt," the king said, seeing the messenger stand wordless. Tehanu did not lift her head. The glossy black hair almost hid the ruin of her face. "My lady," Alder said, dry-mouthed and husky-voiced, "he bade me ask you 2 questions." He paused, only because he had to wet his lips and get his breath in a moment of panic that he had forgotten what he was to say. But the pause became a waiting silence.
Tehanu said, in a voice hoarser than his, "Ask them."
He said to ask first, "Who are those who go to the dry land?" And as I took my leave of him, he said, "Ask my daughter also, Will a dragon cross the wall of stones?
Tehanu nodded her head in acknowledgement and stepped back a little more, as if to carry her riddles away with her, away from them.
The dry land, the king said, and the dragons. His alert gaze went from face to face. Come, he said, let's sit and talk. Perhaps we could talk down in the gardens, said the little gray-eyed woman, Tanar. The king agreed at once. Alder heard Tanar say to him as they went, She finds it hard to be indoors all day. She wants the sky.